Welcome back. This is episode 8 of the podcast, and today is the big gear episode. We'll be covering ISO, Adobe, and the plight there within. Living with Fuji cameras, as I've now officially done several commercial jobs with mine and, you know, have much feedback. Working out lighting setups for shoots, flash kit, especially triggers, GFX tethering will have its own section, as always. And then a load of other tech questions that you guys have all sent in. But yeah, that's how we're going to go. And I'm joined again with Rob.
Hi, folks.
And yeah, I mean, as you probably noticed from the last two episodes, the Q&As, we're running a bit behind at work. We had a death in the family at a very inconvenient time, which now means that we're completely screwed at the studio. So we're sort of playing catch up and trying to get some work completed, I suppose. But yeah, so Rob is considerably more technical than I am.
More of a nerd, for sure, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely more on the techie side to me. I often hand you things and go, make it work. So yeah, that's going to be, I think, useful. And I think the first point I want to bring up here as a photographer being on YouTube is that you do not need to know a great deal about the tech compared to what YouTube makes you think you need to know. And I think I'm living proof of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember one of the first early jobs I did with you. Do you remember the motorized slider you handed me when we did the job of the fire department?
I do indeed remember that motorized slider.
It was just a bag of many bits.
Yes, like, yes.
Rob, can you make this work?
Yes, that's pretty much what I said. Probably verbatim, actually. I know so little, and as we're talking about ISO, that on a shoot last week, it was like a four-day campaign. On day two, I realized I didn't know how to change the ISO on my camera. I still don't. And I can imagine the rage that is going on the internet at the moment. You know, commercial photographer charging what I charge doesn't know how to change ISO on his camera.
I mean, I'd counter that argument with that's not what you're on set being paid for.
Exactly. And we'll probably start with this ISO question because it's probably a good lead into it. Like, someone was asking, how does ISO work? I said, I'll read the question properly, actually, because otherwise I'll butcher it. It's a bit of a noob question, but how does ISO really work for raw photos? And how about bodies with dual gain sensors? Some folks say that the ISO is just metadata in the raw, but how about dual gain sensors? Does this make sense? Yeah. It's a technical question. It's boring as shit. It is boring as shit. Must remember to put a adult only thing on this. I think I've sworn repeatedly in the first 3 minutes. It is boring as shit. And I'm going to tell you what I know about ISO, and then you can tell me what's actually true. So on these video cameras that we're filming this podcast on, they have dual native ISO.
They do, coincidentally, all three of them.
Yeah, oh, brilliant. There we go. So one batch of the ISO, doesn't matter which one you have it in, as long as it's within that range, you can choose the rest of it in post. Whether it's, say, 100 or 800, you can flip that about afterwards. And then when it goes into the second band, you can flit about within that band. You can't change between bands afterwards.
Correct.
One's better in the dark, one's better in the light. And I have a sneaking suspicion that high ISO is better in bright scenes and low ISO better in dark.
In terms of the two ISO bands, that's really just about getting your exposure.
Yeah.
In terms of which is better in the light and the dark, that's a whole different thing altogether.
Exactly. And I don't know the answer. And I do shoot video commercially, and I have had large billboards and bits on TV where I've got no clue. I just go, which one's... I ask the technician, which ISO is best for this situation? They tell me and I work out the rest. That's what I know about videos. It's very difficult to explain dual ISO to someone like me because I'm just like, yeah, which one? What I know about stills is low ISO, generally speaking, has less noise and has more colours, which is very important. The noise I do not care about. The amount of colours you can capture does matter. And as the ISO goes up, you lose colour, is a major one. But also as the ISO goes up, you probably have less colour in the scene anyway because there's less light. I shoot at 100 ISO. Unless we're freezing motion, then I shoot at 200 ISO because you can't quite get enough light out of the pack at the right flash duration for me to do it at f16 at 100 ISO. But you can at 200. Can't tell the difference visually. At 400 on my 100 megapixel sensor, I can start to see the image degrade a little bit. I'd still do it if I had to. Wouldn't really bother me. And I remember back in the Canon days of the 5D Mark II, 160 ISO was peak image quality.
That was the base ISO for that camera.
Yeah. So explain to everyone else what's actually happening with ISO, because my explanation is probably useless.
It's So at least when we're talking about digital sensors now, I mean, obviously back in the film days, it was the sensitivity of the film stock to light.
Yes.
And it works in a similar way with modern cameras. Now, if we take your stills camera, because that's easy, because that's just it's not a dual gain system.
I don't know, it might be. Is it?
I believe not.
Oh, good, let's hope not.
And so basically, again, you will have a base ISO, which isn't always the one with the least noise, but it's generally speaking the one with the best balance of a dynamic range. And which we'll come into more actually when we talk about the Blackmagic cameras and you know, dual gain in particular. Now, the reason that your colours and everything get progressively worse as you go up the ISO is because basically as you're increasing the ISO, what you're actually doing is increasing digital gain.
Yeah.
Now, as the more and more digital gain you push into it, the more noise is introduced, and the noise manifests itself as obviously digital blocks, noise, fixed pattern noise, which you don't want, but also it starts to strip your colours and you lose dynamic range. So that's why you always want to keep it as close to its base ISO as possible in terms of image quality. Now, with these Blackmagic cameras, which was the first one I ever used that had a dual native ISO, is that basically what it is, you have two circuits, and what it is a different level of analog gain for the low band and the high band.
So I just want to interrupt you and let everyone know that I no longer understand what's going on, but Rob, please carry on.
Okay, so the reason, if you take these cameras, they in effect are always shooting at the two ISOs. You've got the low band, which the native ISO on that is 400. You've then got the high band, which runs through a separate analog gain before it gets to that. And that shoots then always at 3,200 ISO. Now, people are correct in that the selection from 1250 up to 6,400 in band two can be selected in post. And also from 100 to 1,000 in band A can be selected in post. Now, the reason you would want to do that is simply because of where as these cameras work, which was a bit of a mind meld when first got used to it. The distribution of the dynamic range is different at 100 ISO or 1,000. So these cameras, for example, have 13 stops of dynamic range, which is obviously your journey between your blacks to whites. Now, that distribution of that 13 stops changes from 100 to 1,000. So when you're using like my old Canon, my 6Ds, for example, rule of thumb, if it's in low light, you push the ISO up. If it's really bright, you have the ISO down. These work completely backwards to that, in as much as a low ISO has the most dynamic range attributed to the shadow information, and the higher ISOs have the most amount of bright dynamic range attached to it. So if you're shooting on a bright day, you want the ISO kind of high. Now, it's already shooting at 400, so we'll just worry about that later. You kind of can't do that because the amount of if you've exposed for 400 and decide you then want to push it up to 1,000, you've just added two stops of digital gain now.
Yeah.
To bring your exposure back to correct. So even though you can select them afterwards, you always want to know what you're shooting at in the first place, and importantly, correctly expose these cameras for the ISO that you want the most dynamic range.
Yeah, it's kind of pick your band, as it were, high or low band. And then, but then like now, so we've just started filming again as it's gone really dark outside. So I just increase the ISO, which obviously gives us less dynamic range in the dark, but it gives us better exposure.
Yeah, I mean, so we're now on band B. Yeah. It's the early video was shot on band A. I wonder if anyone can actually tell the difference.
That'd be an interesting one.
So, but again, because we're at the lowest end of it, in other words, it has the least amount of digital gain applied to the second band, which has an analog gain prior to it, it's much better in terms of noise performance than we would have pushing it 1,000 in band A.
And then, just following on to what do you need to know, all of that information that Rob just gave me, as Rob can probably tell from the blank look on my face, has gone straight out the other side because my brain doesn't work like this. So next time we go to film, I'm still going to say, Rob, what ISO should we use in this scenario?
And that's really the the crux of the matter. All you really need to know is that you should always expose the camera correctly for the ISO you're choosing to use, given on the lighting situation that you're in.
I bet no one could tell the difference between the two different bands we've chosen for this.
Not by the time it's hit with a bit of YouTube compression, no.
Exactly. Like, as long as it looks good, doesn't
it?
I always think, it's good to know this information, and there are times where it's incredibly useful, which is why I always ask you before I do a shoot. But as long as it looks good.
Yeah. And it's always, certainly in terms of light performance, especially with these cameras, because their tolerance for adding digital noise is quite low, actually, even though they've got quite a flexible band. If you're having to push a lot of gain in post, that image breaks apart quite quickly, and then you have to use a load of noise reduction, which then you lose detail. So you always kind of want to keep your exposures kind of where you need them, regardless of what you're shooting.
Yeah, I mean, I always try and get mine pretty much bang on in camera, regardless of the stills or video, for the ISO I'm shooting at, rather than try and push it in post. Sometimes, especially with splash photography, not possible. You have to shoot underexposed to freeze the action at the aperture you need, even with a camera with technical movements. There's so much technical information you can learn. It's insane. But I think the important thing is not to forget to be creative and to actually make images.
And as I say, just expose properly for the given situation. And that I think goes across board.
Yeah. And again, I think I know photographers spanning from like your level of technical ability and knowledge through to mine. I'd say I'm somewhere in the middle, through to people who literally do not have a clue at all, who are all successful. And I think it's just how you work, isn't it? Everyone works differently. Some people are very technical in their work. Some people are very, I don't know, slapdash in their work. But as long as they're getting the results they expect, it all seems to work, doesn't it?
And again, back to something we said in the previous podcast is you as the creative director, in effect, on the set. That's what you're being paid
for. Yeah,
you're not being paid to be there to know the ins and outs of the camera tech. That's not your job. Your job there is to create the image for the client.
But I think a lot of beginner photographers can be really put off by the internet, because they just see these people arguing about like the semantics and like tiny minutiae of detail, and they're like, oh, I don't know what any of this means. Like, you don't need to.
Honestly, you don't need to. I mean, not only that, I mean, certainly you know your channel's been running a while now, and your channel's always been very much focused on the business of photography. You know, you're not a gear review channel. You know, you're very much, this is how things work actually in the commercial world, you know, with 5D Mark IIs held together with tape and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
If it isn't, then you know you're a hobbyist. You know, it's that's the way these things go. And do you remember the amount of rage that you used to get every time you mentioned that you had a retoucher do something to your photo?
Oh my God, yeah.
It's absolutely hate for
that. Anyway, if I mentioned F16, diffraction or chromatic, I don't even know which one it is, but I haven't got mad about something. I'm going to cough. Is my cough going to be taken out of this podcast by the voice isolation, do you think?
Let's find out.
Apologies to everyone's eardrums. Right, so in terms of, tech, we don't need to know a lot. Or you can know a lot. Like, there's so many different ways to be a photographer. There's not like you must know exactly what I know, no more, no less. You can know way more, you can know way less, and you can still have a career because it's a creative industry. But speaking about the trials and tribulations of equipment, I'm going to go and quickly grab my flash trigger because, how am I going to do this while I was talking? Because I'm going to go and grab it quickly because somebody asked me about flash triggers and I want to talk to you about it. But Rob, can you explain the Godox trigger system and its merits? Just throw you under the bus there whilst I go and find one of mine.
Well, as a Godox user, the trigger systems are actually quite good, honestly. They just tend to be very complicated and I suppose not intuitive to use, unlike the Pocket Wizards, which you've been used, which are very, very simple devices in comparison with the Godox triggers.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree. I'd say the Godox trigger, because the Godox one is the same as the Broncolor one, which is much more expensive. It is the same thing, isn't it? The Godox and the Broncolor one.
It's the same thing, pretty much.
And it's awful. Whenever a rental house sends it to me, I cry because they're rubbish. Much like the Profoto one with about 10,000. The Profoto's got two triggers. One's got a nice digital display and it works really well. And the other one, instead of a digital display, it's have every possible button on the top. There's just like a sea of buttons. And because of that, and because I'm always using rental kit and other people's kit for jobs, I always take my own triggers. And I use Pocket Wizards, and they're called the Plus X. The reason I use these is because, and for those on video, you can see whilst I'm doing this, but they take AA batteries, so you can just go and pop those in from anywhere. Mm-hmm. which I think most triggers do double A.
Yeah.
It works on any camera with a hot shoe from any era, including like the 1950s. And it works on any flash with a PC sync port, which is any flash. So every time I turn to a job, I use these because they always work the same. They work on any camera and any flash combination I could possibly have. And they don't do anything fancy. And because of that, I know it's going to work.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the plus sides of the Godox, for example, in that, you know, you can assign multiple groups, you know, and all have different flash power. It's all done from where you sat and all that's lovely. But how often do you find yourself using 15 lights these days?
Well, last week, I think we used 8. Still looks like a one light setup that you've just been editing them, haven't you?
Yeah.
There's about 8 lights in there. But never, we've got packs on the floor as well. So all the packs tend to end up near the camera. And then we've also actually got a wireless app for the packs. So we can do that all from the digital capture station. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think these are good. They're expensive for what they are, considering they do nothing but fire.
No, I mean, you can buy something that does exactly what that does for about a tenner on Amazon.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do it exactly the same way. And it doesn't work every time.
Yeah, these are idiot-proof.
And especially when you're in a quite, you work in set, you know, you'll have a job down in London. And there's all manner of electrical interference in the, you know, with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth.
Yeah, and often in these big studios, there's like 7 studio rooms in a big, like, big sky. They've got loads of studios. And if everyone's on the same
Everybody firing everybody else's triggers.
Yeah, and I've had that happen before where I'm like trying to find a channel that no one else is using. And these work well for that because Pocket Wizards are on their own specific frequency, which no other trigger is.
Yeah.
So worst case scenario, you're just battling with another Pocket Wizard user. And these have got... How many got? 10 channels.
Satisfying bit of ASMR.
I know, I love that. Nice little... nice clicks. I bet they get taken out by the noise cancellation. It's just silence there. But yeah, that's what I use, nice and simple flash triggers. But going from that into the Fuji life, living with Fuji, we just finished, well, I've shot everything on Fuji since I got it, including ad campaigns. And I've also been shooting ad campaigns on Fuji without a backup camera because I forgot that I didn't have one, which is a bit of a faux pas. I had other cameras. I got a couple of 5DSRs still kicking around because they're just not worth much secondhand, so why sell them? It seems daft to get like 600 quid for a camera when it's worth
and much. And it's a perfectly serviceable camera, should you need to use it.
So I've still got that kicking around. We've got a cam bay for that as well, so I can change it all around and camera and shooting. I have ordered another Fuji because I am now fully committed to Fuji life. And I will be using Fuji for everything. However, it is one of the most frustrating cameras I've ever used. On the last shoot, I went to go and take a frame, and every time I pressed the button, it just said sensor cleaning. So I had to turn it off, unplug it, replug it in, turn it back on again to make it work. I don't know what happened. No one touched it in between me touching it and doing it again. Still don't know where the ISO button is, so that's obviously intuitive. But yeah, it's just not great, and the tethering is now perfect. We've got it dialed in
finally
after spending
six months
testing out different brands cables and area, what's the name of it, area 5120, what's the weird
51, the 51, place yeah, that doesn't exist in Nevada, honest,
yeah, oh yeah. The area 51 cable is the one to use. Now somebody, and this is a really interesting thing which I want to make a point of here, somebody said, not so much of a question but more comment, I have the GFX 100S and I run power through the cable with no issues. I have very high quality cables, however. I know you said that it had on good authority that it shouldn't be done. Not sure why. So, and explain touching flashes, which we'll get to as well. So this is one of those things. It's like, somebody's told me, and this person who's told me is the digital tech for the country. And we are one of the two biggest countries for photography. The top person has said, do not do it. I didn't ask him why. I just went, cool. I won't do it. I'll pass the message on. Now, I obviously tethered with power coming through my cable at first because I thought, what a great feature. I was told not to, so I stopped. Didn't question why, because he knows why, and he wouldn't say that if it wasn't a thing that you needed to do. And every Digitech I've since has gone, make sure you've got this turned off. I don't know why. I've never had an issue with it turned on, but I won't turn it on again because I've been told by people who know not to do it. Of course, you might not have an issue for ages until it really matters. It's like people who go, I've driven my car for 100,000 miles, I've never changed the spark plugs. But what they've actually done is destroyed half their engine because it's been misfiring for the last 40,000 miles. Just because there's no fatal error today doesn't mean there isn't one in the post.
Yeah, or, you know, it's waiting for you.
Exactly. So, you know, when someone in the know tells me this, I just go, sure, sounds good. So we don't power via that cable. We use the, what are they called, Sony NPF?
Yeah.
Batteries and a dummy battery into the camera to power it. Go through two of those, maybe three on a shoot.
Yeah.
It's got live view on
the day. They're great.
They're great. It takes a while to charge them by chargers. We need to get better chargers in the studio, don't we?
I told you about this.
Yeah, let's order those after this, actually. We'll get those. But yeah, I've got like 12 of those on rotation. They go into that, so probably three a day. Takes another day to charge them at the moment. So.
Yeah.
Not ideal. But yeah, the Fuji is just problematic. But it is, again, it's their first 100 megapixel camera. It's going to be, there's a better version out now, which costs a little bit more money. I'm tight. Am I going to spend the extra money?
Probably not.
No, probably not.
But it's one of those, once you kind of got used to its little idiosyncrasies, it becomes fine because you're used to it.
Yeah, it's like the old P45s on the Phase DF bodies. They were a nightmare. There's this like weird error you constantly got. And like you say, once you know that error is not terminal, all you have to do is unplug, replug, off you go. You don't stress about it. You just go, oh, the connections need redoing. And I think people are like, oh, well, you could afford the better camera. Go and buy the better camera. It's like, yeah, I could do. But why? And then also you get to the things like, well, I could afford two of those. I could really afford an IQ 350 megapixel with a phase. Buy two of those. I could go and buy two. And it's like, where do you stop?
Yeah.
At some point you have to, like, I always go, what is the least amount of money I can spend to get the job done?
Yeah, it's the sweet spot. I mean, the value of the image quality for the price paid, and, you know, we've often talked about managing your costs.
Yeah.
To, you know, the route to any successful business is to know what your costs are and manage them appropriately.
Yeah.
You know, so again, you can spend three times as much on a camera system that doesn't get you three times more money. It gets you exactly the same amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, I've just shot on what, a £7,000 camera rig on this shoot we're just editing. Mm-hmm. And we did the same shoot last year, which would have cost me £2,000 for the camera rig. And we got paid the same. Slightly more usage, but that's irrelevant to the actual shoot. But yeah, we got paid the same. Didn't make any more money. Got the same job I would have got anyway. They booked me on the basis of the stuff I shot on a Canon.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, does it matter? You've got to draw the line somewhere. Otherwise, it's like a never-ending, like...
And, you know, as you often say, if there's a job, and people will ask for things, but, I mean, especially in the film world, people will insist that it's shot on an Arri.
Yes.
Nobody owns one.
You
just rent them. Because they're prohibitively expensive machines. So, and if you need one, and likewise for yourself, it makes sense because the Fuji is quite well priced for, you know, the image quality that it delivers. And if you need that extra little push off the cliff, as Spinal Tap would say, you just rent the phase.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I'd love to own. I'd love to own a Hasselblad, to be fair, but with a phase back, because Hasselblad's tech is awful. But the cameras, like the old 500cms, are beautiful. I think I'd very much go for one of those. Do you have a dream camera? I've never asked you before.
It would be the Arri, the Alexa.
Yeah, that's the Alexa, isn't it? How much is that?
About 60 grand, body only.
Oh, you know, we do enough retouching this year.
Well, you know.
Then you don't spend money on anything else.
No, I mean, you know, I've arms like Popeye.
Yeah.
By the time I finish that, my retouching to earn that. But again, it's how often would you need it? You know, hardly ever.
Yeah, yeah. Nice to have the same with Hasselblad.
But it's one of those purchases that it'll make you feel good, but how much better is it really? I mean, I have shot on a Red. The Red's a very interesting one. I mean, as you may or may not know, it's been bought by Nikon.
Yep.
Or Nikon, depending on what part of the world you're from.
I would say Nikon.
So, I mean, that's interesting for them because there's all sorts of rumours where Red's concerned. And Red are about half the price of an Arri,
yeah,
give or take, but always known as being much less good and, importantly, not reliable. Even given the high price tag, you know, you have to have a spare one on set.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't with an Arri, you just have one and it will work. You know, you can basically destroy the thing and it will just keep on trucking. And then also an interesting one is that every film that's, you know, won, you know, an Academy Award for the image, their best picture, has always been shot on an Arri. Red haven't actually won one. Red seemed very popular for TV use.
They do, don't they? Yeah.
Because they have that kind of I suppose, more contrasty, sort of gritty look to it.
Yeah.
That's quite desirable for a lot of TV shows. But again, you would just rent one. You wouldn't necessarily want to own one. And again, I know a guy that, again, did the thing. His dream camera was at some point owner red, and he bought it. And he said, I wish I hadn't.
Yeah. Well, I have this conversation with a lot of people. I mean, like, bang, I think bang for buck again, video camera wise, is the Black Magic, isn't it?
I mean, literally unbeatable, honestly. It's,
which is why we both use them.
I mean, I was the first time I shot with it. And again, I only upgraded from the 6D for video, which I still use for stills because there's nothing wrong with it. I was booked to shoot a Kickstarter campaign in around Birmingham. And I wanted to do some nice fancy slow-mo and or what have you. And the 6D, really not very good at that at all. Not only does it drop it down to 720p, but also there's just moiré for days.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, creatively I couldn't do what I wanted to do with that piece of hardware. And that really is the only time that you should really upgrade, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then I bought the Blackmagic. Again, this thing didn't exist at the time. I, as you know, was a very early adopter. As soon as it came out, more or less, I'm like,
That's the one.
That's what I need.
So how long have you had yours for then?
2019 when they first came out. So 5 years now.
Yeah.
So the relative dinosaurs.
Yeah. Yeah. Up on the YouTube world. Because I've had mine for a few years, haven't I? My 6K.
Yeah.
I only got the 6K because it fit my lenses without adapters. And I was like, that's easy. Which so here's a wicked segue into the next one. Boring tech question. I'll go through this one quickly. Have you compared Mamiya RB67 lenses to 6.5 lenses for optical performance? Want to try using 6.5 lenses for stitched short tele shots? Should I stick to native brand shift lenses? I photograph artworks for a living. So the reason, and I know that the cost of Mamiya RB and RZ 6.7 lenses has gone up astronomically, is because people saw me using them and started buying them. Now, the reason I shoot with the Mamiya RB and RZ, I say Z for some reason when I say Mamiya, 6.7 lenses, is not because they are the best lens available. It's because I already had a Mamiya RZ 6.7 and I already had the lenses. So when Cambo was an option, I went, oh, I can already put these lenses on it. So I put those lenses on it. There are better lenses out there, but those lenses were what I had. And why buy more? You always lose money when you trade kit and buy new kit.
Yeah, and you already had them, and optically they were better than the camera body systems you were using at the time anyway.
Yeah, they're still better than the, you know. The image circle is bigger than a 6.5. Obviously, it's a 6x7 centimeter image it creates. I mean, if I was photographing artwork, why do we need to stitch shots together? Just use a high-resolution camera.
It depends if you have that available to you, if you have the budget for it.
Oh, and you get a 50 megapixel camera quicker than you can adapt to, cheaper than you can adapt to Mamiya RZ onto. The other thing is the RZ is focused by bellows. The 6.5 is focused by lens.
Yeah.
So they're two very different focus things. Optically, 6.5 lenses, we sometimes use them on the phase still because that phase one is Mamiya from back in the day. And the later autofocus ones, especially the 80, it's all right. It's not as good as the blue ring phase by a long shot, but it's cheap. The Mamiya 6.7s are better. So I'd go Mamiya 6.7 is probably the best, then Mamiya 6.5, then probably Nikon, but you won't know the difference.
So there we go.
There goes some niche lens knowledge, having owned all of those. But yes, so I'm going to cough again. I do apologize if this doesn't come out within the edit. Adobe getting hate. They did something bad with AI and training stuff and stealing stuff and prices. My Adobe subscription is like 70 quid a month.
Yeah, it's not a cheap day out at the race, is it?
No.
I mean, there's the unfortunate thing with Adobe is that they have been for the longest time effectively industry standard.
Yeah.
Like, for example, you know, we would talk about why you use Broncolor kit and why you use certain triggers and so on. It's because every assistant knows how to use them.
Yep.
In the same way that people going through university, you know, doing a degree in graphic design or whatever, everybody's using Adobe. So when they go out into the big wide world, they already know how to use it. And the thing that Adobe do that nobody else really does do is the synergy between its products. If you're working in InDesign, it plugs directly into Illustrator for your vectors and Photoshop for your images, and it all just links together beautifully. Now, individually, there's alternatives to that software. What there isn't is an alternative to the ecosystem.
Apart from for photography. So this here is saying, you know, considering how much hate Adobe receives, is there an alternative? Is there any free software that you use and can recommend? Free software? No, it's all free for a reason. There's GIMP, which is a Photoshop thing, yeah, but it,
don't
it,
just Google that on its own.
Do not Google download GIMP. That's a bad day. That's your web history ruined. Targeted adverts you don't want to see. But nobody uses anything professionally apart from Photoshop. So we use Capture One. That is industry standard. Capture One has always been industry standard.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from for wedding photographers who use Lightroom.
Because it's fast.
It's not as fast as Capture One. I don't know why they use Lightroom. It's just a thing. I don't know. There's no logical reason.
Well, I remember like when I started shooting sort of, you know, big gigs like downloading or what have you, where you come back with literal thousands of images. There was a plugin for Lightroom called Photo Mechanic.
If you remember, I do.
And I don't know if that was available to Capture One users.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, maybe not.
So that was possibly the reason that Lightroom sort of gained a bit of traction for.
It could well be. Because I mean, like in terms of like commercial work, Capture One is better because I was going to throw in computers here as well because someone was asking what computers we use, but because it works with Phase One systems because it's made by Phase One.
Yep.
Tethering is flawless. Adobe's tethering is atrocious.
It's pretty bad.
It's horrific. It opens a RAW file up as a better starting point than Lightroom. Don't know why, but I've done it side by side. It's better. The sliders have better mechanics in the background. They work better. And if you use Apple, which everyone in the industry does, if anyone wonders why every photo shoot is using an Apple computer, it's because you can also run Capture Pilot, which is a wireless Apple server thingy where you can all get your phones out. My assistant can walk around with his iPad and fire the frame from all over the place. Yeah. Clients have got iPads with images coming up on it. You know, so the person asking what computers we use, I mean, you use Apple, don't you? It's built inside a PC, but it's Apple.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, my
OS.
It's running Mac OS, but it's in a PC. So
yeah.
What loosely termed a Hackintosh.
Yeah, it's a Hackintosh, and we just have Apple everything because it works with everything. But yeah, so the alternative to Adobe is Capture One for tethering and grading, and then if you wanted free after that, GIMP, but no, Photoshop.
And Photoshop on its own is actually reasonable value. I think they do a photographer's bundle, I think, for £11 a month, I think.
Yeah,
it is, where you get Photoshop and Lightroom. And actually, that's fairly...
Can I just have that? Do I need any of the other software?
Honestly, no.
Am I just paying, like, was it £840? Yeah,
you're paying for the whole cloud, because if you need more than one piece of software that isn't Lightroom and Photoshop... I mean, I think I can count on the number of times I've used Illustrator here on one hand.
Yeah, but I used to use it, but now do you know what I use? Google Slides. Because you can get video to play in Google Slides, and you can no longer do that inside.
No, InDesign, I mean, it never worked properly in InDesign. Anyway.
Do you know what? At the end of this call, I'm going to save myself almost £1,000 by getting rid of it all, and if I need it, I'll rebuy it. Because that's silly money I'm spending. Capture One's not cheap either, though, but I buy it annually. And stupidly, all my annual stuff I did at one point. So it's like, oh, there's no money coming out. And then one day each year, it's £3,500.
With an avalanche of payments.
Yeah, all my like music and all the rest of it all comes out in one go. I don't know. People hate Adobe. People hate, but this is interesting. So the internet photography world hates Adobe. But every time Capture One does an update, there's all these like private chats we're in. Everyone's going nuts. Like, why? It works perfectly. Why have they changed it? This now, like, you're on set and you can no longer do something you do on every shoot. And yeah, it's just, it's annoying. But there we go. So, lighting. Lighting is a big part of my work specifically, as you all know.
Yes.
I might not know much about anything else. Like, I don't know how to change the ISO on my camera, but I know how to light. That is like my number one skill. I'd say, was that a fair...
Yeah. I mean, definitely. It's, you know, I mean, the thought of you using natural light is unheard of.
Yeah. Lighting is my thing. I can light anything. I might not understand the technical words for what I'm doing, but there's nothing I can't. I've never come across something I can't do for a client when they've asked for, like, you know, they want hard, soft light with this, that. I can always do it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm quite good at, like, working that out. But this question is, how do you work out lighting levels, positions? Is it trial and error or, you know, experience? And it's mathematics. You learn the inverse square law, you learn exposure values, and that's it, you know. And then it's just mixing it in with creative. So it's, what do you want the light to look like? So the last shoot, they wanted a summer vibe. So we went, right, this is summer vibe. We want some nice specular light coming in. The sun is low in the sky and it's going to be hard shadows. So from that, we know it's going to be a low angled light. It's going to be far away and we're going to use a reflector.
Yeah.
And I can then work out from the spill of light that we need and the evenness of light, how far away that light needs to be. Then the sides of the reflector to make the shadow how I want it to look. And then the, you know, how much light I need to have for my F1600 ISO settings, which I use for everything.
I mean, I remember the early days, I mean, when you were even using speed lights.
Yeah, yeah.
Often with three or four of them gaff taped together.
Exactly. Couldn't afford a flash.
Just to get enough power.
So yeah, we used to buy like three or four cheap Yongnuo or something like that, speed lights, and gaffer taped them all together.
And God, I remember, I mean, it was like being in the army, you're handing me burnt speed lamps. Rob, give me another flash.
Yeah, this one's melted.
And they were basically melting as fast as I could give you another one.
Yeah, so you hooked them up to like big battery packs, didn't we? So they'd fire.
So yeah, the lithium packs.
Yeah, they were good. They were good days.
They were Godox. The PV100s, whatever they were.
Yeah, I think I still got one kicking around somewhere.
Yeah.
They're decent. I broke a few of those as well. But yeah, it is all mathematics, lighting is. First, we have to understand what you're trying to create as a look. Then you just have to like extrapolate backwards from there.
Yeah, but you also have to figure in, look, how many days, weeks, months, years have you spent doing, again, personal work, test shoots, to be able to dial that in that fast for the client when they're asking for something on the fly on set?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've done 15 years of lighting. I can now go, well, if the light's this far away and it's at 8.3 on the pack, then I'm coming in at F18 and my sensor will record that nicely at F16.
And it's like, if you look at the journey, like, I mean, I remember you doing a shoot for Premier Drums.
Yeah.
And I think, was it 13 lights you used on that? Something like that? And now a lot of the stuff I see is just one light.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I can do super technical lighting, but I don't think it looks good is the problem. I think it looks better if you do one light perfectly.
Yeah. I think, and a lot of that down to, I mean, when you, in your daily life, what's your light source? It's the sun.
Yeah.
There's one of it in the
light
sky.
Light looks pretty good. I mean, we're just being lit by the windows today. We're always actually on this podcast. We don't artificially light it. It just looks better.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it's quite dark in here, which is, you know, while we've moved up on the ISO band.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah.
You know, so I think by using one light, it's more common what you're used to seeing, like, you know, the hard light, soft light, if a cloud comes over.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, but you don't see 13 of them in the sky, at least not on this planet.
No, exactly. And, you know, I mean, like, even like the last shoot you just edited now, it was like a 6 or 8 light setup, to be fair, which looks like one light, but that was problem solving for a client. They're like, oh, can we get a bit more light in on this here?
Yeah.
Can we get a little ping just there? And I'm like, of course, can. And it still looks like one light.
And of course, one light's never one light, is it? You know, there's always a bounce card or something. You know, sort of pushing a bit of light in here, mirrors, and, you know, all sorts of little tricks and trade. But
then, I mean, I think experience is such a key part of it. Because even I remember when I used to shoot weddings, and I used to shoot like 2 or 3 a week. I'd be able to walk into a room and go 1250 ISO, 60th of a second, 2.8 quarter bounced off the ceiling. It'll be perfect exposure.
Yeah.
And it just being right all the time. I'd always know the exposure.
Yeah, you set and forget.
But, you know, I was doing 30 to 40 hours of shooting a week. And then I was doing other stuff on the side, like portraits and stuff. So, yeah experience is king. But, yeah, it's all just logical stuff, really. Everyone needs to learn. If you don't know the inverse square law, then you don't know how to light. It's like the one thing you must know.
And importantly, practice.
Yeah, just keep doing it. Keep doing it. So the last two little bits we've got here, one's about which kit to buy, and the other one I'm going to start now is, how are you enjoying or disliking the video aspect of professional work? And obviously you do video all the time.
I'm very much more video centric. And that makes sense to me because I don't read, as you know.
Yeah.
I'm not a reader. I think I've read like 3 books since I left school. And that was that was a long time ago. So I don't kind of sit there and look at pictures, where most of my entertainment, my ingest is by watching films.
Yep.
That's what I enjoy. That's what inspires me. That's what I like. So it makes sense for me to move from stills to now creating my own films and such like, because that, you know, I have a lot of love and passion and joy for that. So for me, I absolutely love it and applaud it.
You love the change. I'm indifferent about my change of moving towards video. I don't like it more, I don't like it less. It's just more work. It's like, I like it. You know, it's fine. Yeah. I enjoy it as much as I enjoy the stills. It's the only thing is, you can't fix it in post as cheaply.
No, it's time consuming. And also in terms of lighting, it's a different, you know, running continuous as opposed to strobes. I mean, the sheer amount of power that you get from a strobe.
My electric bills for like video stuff and strobes is just insane.
Yeah, it's just absolutely huge. I mean, you use the aperture systems for your video lights. And I'm always shocked every time I see the size of the power pack for them. It's like,
yeah, it's nuts, isn't it? But I think the other thing is, like, so I'm predominantly a stills photographer, but because of doing the podcast and because of doing the YouTube channel and the workshops, I probably spend more physical hours per week filming video, despite it not being my main breadwinner.
Yeah, again, this is very much, a passion project you started because there was no YouTube channels really talking about the business of commercial photography.
Exactly.
Everything was kind of gear reviews and, Top Gear style. What happens if we give one of the best photographers in the world this Lego camera?
I did enjoy those Digital Red videos.
They were great. Yeah. Chase Jarvis. I love him. He's brilliant.
He's a great guy. He's doing different stuff now, though. He sold his company, didn't he?
Yeah.
So good for him. I hope he made a good bit of wad out of that.
Yeah, I don't think he's skint, honestly.
No, I think he's all right. Maybe I should email him. I'll see. I'll get Pete to do it. I probably won't get a response. Right, so last thing we're going to look at here is gear. And this is, I'm trying gig photography, so music photography.
Yeah.
And don't have loads to spend on good zooms and have no intention of going into debt for it. Wise. I'm using a 60, just like yours.
Great camera.
I'm looking at buying a Canon 24-70 2.8 Mark I. Is there any alternative to this lens? Yes, there is. There is a cheap Sigma version of it. But
the Gold Ring Sigma just don't.
Is it that bad?
Unless it's got the art series.
Yeah.
Don't buy Sigma lens. That's a bit free.
What I would do if I was, I mean, the 24-70 2.8 is pretty cheap secondhand, so you've not got loads of money to play with there. It's like a couple of hundred.
Yeah, and it is quite flexible.
It's all right.
You know, I mean, as a one and done gig lens.
Do you know what I'd do though? I'd buy a 28 1.8 gold ring and an 85 1.8 gold ring.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the 85mm and I love it. I just don't use it.
Yeah, it's a great lens. I shot loads on that when I was working. And the 28 is my favourite focal length. It's the best storytelling focal length. But yeah, 24-70 2.8 do the job. I've got one in here. We use it still. I don't know where it's gone to, but we always use it.
Yeah,
it's a good lens.
I mean, the only thing I'll say what made your life easier in terms of gig photography again, because you get basically three songs.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, if it's a decent gig, because, you know, I used to be the house photographer for the O2 Academy back in the day. And you get three songs and then you get turfed out.
Yeah.
So exactly the same thing at download, unless you're shooting Marilyn Manson, because he hates photographers.
Yeah.
And you get a bit of one song if you're very, very lucky, after he spends 20 minutes filling the stage with smoke. But definitely would always recommend, find a bit of money and buy a second 60 and have two on you. Because again, if one breaks, That's your day over.
Yeah, I mean, I used to rock 2.5D Mark IIs. I had a 70-200 in one and a 35 1.4 in the other. And in my pocket, I had a 22.8, and I'd swap that if I wanted some super wide stuff.
Yeah.
Like big stages, you mostly 70-200. 35 is the whole
thing. Just the
stage.
Distance that you are away.
Yeah, small venues, 35 is pretty decent. 70-200 is probably a bit long.
Yeah, I mean, the 70-200 is one of those lenses that you don't need that often, but when you need it, you need it.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as I stopped doing portraits, I sold it the next day because it's horribly heavy. But I had the Mark I of that as well. I remember people turning up.
I borrowed it numerous times.
People used to rock up and have like the 5D Mark III or the 1DX. And I'd be like, oh no.
The machine gun, yes.
All those autofocus points. And I've got one to focus and recompose. I never missed focus. And as soon as I got the 5DS and used the autofocus, because I was still shooting portraits when I got that camera, I missed focus so many times. Not because the camera wasn't able to do it, because I selected the wrong point. I'm like, oh.
And I'll be amazed if it wasn't the case, but the focus system in the 6D, I'm certain, is almost exactly, if not the same, as the 5D Mark II.
I think it's better in the 6D. I think it focuses in darker rooms or something.
Yeah,
like
it goes -3 EV in the center point.
Yeah.
Exactly like the 5D, you can only use a center point.
Yeah, the center point only is the one.
And you just get so used to the focus, recompose, that you get to get used to doing it fast.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I never even thought about it. I was always focus, recompose. And you've got manual override as well if you need to adjust.
And there's always the one time where you're at a gig, and this happened to me once, which is another reason you always have two cameras, if one starts having a bit of a moment.
Yeah,
and it wasn't the camera's fault, it was my thumb, because I was back button focus, I was hit the point select next to it and moved it to one of the others.
No.
And I was like, why is the camera just not focusing? And again, you're under pressure because you've only got three songs to get your shots. I'm like, I'll grab the other camera and just
put
the camera.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember once picking up my camera, turning it on, and it just came up with this blue error message on the back screen. I was like, oh, that's dead then. It was a PC board replacement, as is every Canon repair. You got a problem, we'll replace the PCB board.
Yeah.
But yeah, have you got any gear purchases coming up? Are you buying anything new?
I've just been building my lighting for video lighting rigs now, more than anything else. So I've got two Blackmagic Pocket 4Ks.
Yeah.
And I'm perfectly satisfied with those.
Yeah.
I can't see any reason to upgrade them unless one of them breaks, or properly breaks, because Blackmagic's always a little bit broken.
Yeah, there's always a fault somewhere.
You know, I mean, both cameras have a fault.
Yeah.
It's not the same fault. So you have to remember which camera is you're using at any given sort of time. But in terms of that side of things, I'm quite happy. My computer rig is recently upgraded, as you know.
Yeah.
So that's running, faster than a Stabberat at the minute. So that's happy with that. So really, for me, I've got all the lenses that I would want for my personal use and for commercial. I mean, for anything commercial, be using Sigma Art lenses.
Yeah.
If we want to go really fancy, I'll just hire some anamorphics if we need that look. And then I've got my vintage lens set that I shot my second film with, like from the 50s and 60s, you know, the old radioactive Russian lenses.
Yeah, it's looming away.
Stolen directly from the Carl Zeiss factory. So really for me now, it's just building up lighting rigs,
and
make sure I've got, enough lights for any sort of given situation, which you'd kind of expected if you're being hired as a director of photography.
Yeah.
I've got three projects coming up where that is the case. So that's really all I'm concentrating on now, is just buying sort of logical lighting upgrades. In terms of cameras and lenses, I've got enough kit, don't need any more.
Yeah.
As much as we touched on earlier, as much as I'd love an Arri, it's not going to happen anytime soon. So
that's fair.
You know, so these for me are perfectly acceptable, great, love the way, and importantly, I've learned how to use them properly now.
Yeah, that's the thing with not changing kit so often, like you really understand it.
Yeah, and it was always said that it's better to know your kit inside out than to have the best kit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like having shot with those Canon 5Ds for 15 years, like it felt really strange moving to a new camera. My work definitely suffered for it.
The Fuji, and then of course the menu systems are completely alien.
Yeah. But yeah, luckily I just didn't even try to learn it, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, I think I've got all the gear I'm ever going to need. There's nothing.
Well, you actually had a clear out, didn't you?
I did. I've got loads more to sell as well. And loads of car parts as well. Now I've changed cars. Got loads of leftover Mercedes bits that I no longer need.
Well, that's right. Yes. If anyone's looking for any,
early 2000 Mercedes parts, give me a shout. I also just found three Apple CarPlay devices in the back of there after we installed a brand new one I just bought.
That
was good use of money.
Well, if there's eBay.
Yeah, there will be eBay. And interestingly, I opened up my new car, which is a Japanese Subaru, and it's all Fuji equipment inside it. So now I've gone full Fuji.
You have committed fully.
I'm fully committed to the brand.
Even the electronics in your own car.
Yeah, but I don't think there's anything I need. Do you know what I do need, actually? I say there's nothing else I need. I need more mini C-stands, the short ones.
Yeah, they're great.
Two more of those and probably two more C-stands, because on the last two shoots we've done, we've used every single C-stand, and I've already got a lot, but I need more. And then it's just building out the new studio, which is literally going to be plug sockets in, paint down on the floor, paint on the walls, done. Got all the kit already, got the furniture already.
Yeah, and then we can have something resembling a permanent location for this.
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll be able to do a permanent location for this. It might be like with the way I'm going to feng shui it with the workshop behind us, which might be a bit off-brand for this, but...
Well, we'll have to see how that will shape.
See how it looks. But yeah, there we go. We're going to wrap it up. We're under an hour, which is impressive, but we don't really have much to talk about with gear.
No, I mean, it's, and at the same time, you could spend hours talking about it.
Oh, yeah. But then, I think I'd get bored. And then I'd assume everyone else would get bored. I don't know, maybe not. Maybe you want more gear talking. Let me know in the comments below if you do want more talks about gear. We can talk about anything. We often talk about anything, but yeah, there we go. Anything you want to add before we sign off?
No, I think that's quite enough for me for one day, I think.
Amazing. Two podcasts in one day. There's a joke in there somewhere. I'm going to leave it. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Ciao for now.